We are in chapter 3 of Ezra. Still, but not for long. I expect us to actually move into Perek Daled, move into chapter 4, but there's a lot still to say about chapter 3. We learned about Yeshua ben Yozadok, the Kohen Gadol, and he's going to take a very strong leadership role, as we're going to see, besides his religious role as the Kohen Gadol. We learned about the Jews coming to Yerushalayim, building a Mizbeach in the seventh month, the restarting of Karbanot, certain sacrifices, not all of the sacrifices, but some of them are restarted. You can't have all of them until there is a building around the Mizbeach, until you have a Beis HaMikdash, you have a temple. That doesn't exist yet. And we learned about their celebration of Sukkot, doing as Shlomo did. They dedicate the Mizbeach at the time when Shlomo dedicated the first Beis HaMikdash. And we talked a little bit about why Sukkot, gave a couple of other ideas. And now they're ready to go. But before they go, we have to deal with a problem. And this is what we left off with in the beginning of last week. You see, at the end of last week, I should say. The problem that we have is that we just described events that took place when? When were these events? Bachodesh HaShvi, the seventh month. We assume it's the first year that they're in the land. Right? We assume that just because Pasuk Ches, sentence 8 in chapter 3, is going to start Ubashana Ashenis in the second year. So since the next one is going to be in the second year, presumably right now we're in the first year. I think that we can hopefully agree with that. The Gemara and Rosh Hashanah will have a nice discussion about that, but we're not going there right now. The point is that we describe the seventh month of the first year as the time when they build their Mizbeach, and then they're going to get started on building a Beis HaMikdash. Right? And they celebrate Sukkot. I want you to please flip ahead to Nehemiah, chapter 7. And specifically, the beginning of the chapter first is on page 1851. Nehemiah is speaking. Right? This is the first person. Nehemiah is talking. And he says, reading through it quickly, it happened after the wall was built. I directed its doors, the gatekeepers, the singers, the other Levites were designated. I appointed Hanani, my brother, Hanani, officer of the palace over Jerusalem, and I gave them instructions. Right? And then God inspired me. I assembled the aristocrats and the nobles to trace their lineage, and I found the book of lineage of those who had come in the beginning. And then it's going to spend a whole lot of time, we're not reading it out right now, recounting our original list with some variations. We mentioned that when we went through this initially in chapter 2. But then, jump please, to the end of that list, sentence 69, where we find out, right after the census, how they gave different amounts for getting things started. And then the top of page 1855. The top of page 1855, sentence 72. This is the smoking gun. Vayiga HaChodesh HaShvi'i, the seventh, well, actually I jumped the first half of the sentence, right, because I took the paragraph break. Vayeshua Kohanim Valavim Vashorim Vamashorim Lumin Ha'am Vanesinim V'chol Yisrael Bareham. The Jews all settled in their cities, which is what we know happened, right, after the census in chapter 2. Vayiga HaChodesh HaShvi'i. That phrase should sound familiar, mm-hmm. Right? That's the same phrase we used before. The seventh month arrived, Uvnei Yisrael Barehem, and the Jews were in their cities. Now, if you asked me, stopping right now, I would say he's still telling the story from the beginning. In other words, here is the census, and here is the list of who gave what, and then they went to their cities, and then the seventh month arrived, and, right? But keep on reading. Ve'ye'asfu, chapter 8, sentence 1. Ve'ye'asfu chol ha'am ki'ish echad al harachov asher lefnei shar ha'mayim. And the whole nation gathered as one to the street in front of the water gate. Ve'yomru le'ezra ha'sofer, and they told Ezra, la'havi ha'sefer taras Moshe asher tziva Hashem es Yisrael. They told Ezra to bring the Torah, and Ezra brought the Torah, and he read it aloud. biyom echad lachodesh hashvi'i, on the first day of the seventh month. Wait. Ezra wasn't in our story. Ezra's not going to show up until the seventh chapter of Sefer Ezra. So why is Ezra in this apparent retelling? And he's reading, he's having a public reading of the Torah. Not just that, it gets better. Jump down, please, to chapter 8, sentences 9 and 10. Still in Nehemiah. Still on page 1855. After the reading of the Torah scroll. Vayomer Nehemiah. As in Nehemiah, who, again, also isn't there yet, right? Right, he had been me before this. Who Hatir Shasa? He is the ruler. We talked about Hatir Shasa as a title before. Ve'ezra Kohen Asofer Ve'alevim Hamavinim Es Ha'am L'chol Ha'am Hayom Kadoshu L'Hashem Elokechem. They declare today is holy to God. Don't mourn, etc. You shall celebrate. And it continues from there. Actually, I don't need to go into that so much, except that I wanted to show you in particular what happens at the bottom of the page. Chapter 8, start with sentence 13. Ubayom HaSheni, on the second day of their gathering, Nesfu Rashei Ha'avos L'chol Ha'am, all the families get together, their leadership get together, the Kohanim, the Levim, they all come to Ezra, they're going to learn Torah. And lo and behold, Vayimtzu'u Kasuf Ba'Torah, they found written in the Torah, Asher Tziva Hashem Biyad Moshe Asher Yishvu B'nei Yisrael Basukos Bechag B'chodesh HaShvi'i. Look at that. We have a pasuk in the Torah, and it says we should sit in the sukkah. And so on. Vashay Yashmiu B'Aviru Kol B'chol Areihem U'Yushalayim, that they should pass the news throughout Jerusalem, throughout all their cities, saying, Tzu Ahar, go out to the mountains, V'Aviru Alei Zayis, V'Alei Eitz Shemen, V'Alei Hadas, V'Alei Tamarim, V'Alei Eitz Avos, bring... Sound familiar? Mm. Aside from the eighth shemen, the oil wood, we have, and the ali zayit, right, and you have the olive wood, hadasim, tamarim, lulavim, lasos sukkos, to make sukkot, kakatuv, as is written in the Chumash. Well, now I have more problems than you can shake a stick at, right?
Did they just finish reading it?
I have so, right, oral aluf. The I mean, where do you even begin? First of all, does that mean that the original purpose of the four species, or three out of the four species, was to make a sukkah? So that we're not going to address until we get to Nehemiah Perek Zayin. That's far out of where we are right now. But more to the point, we made a big deal about how they celebrated Sukkot in the seventh month in our account. So now I don't understand. Is this recounting what happened in Ezra chapter 3? I told you this was going to be a problem. Is this recounting what happened in Ezra chapter 3? And if it is, because it's talking about a sukkah and it's talking about the dedication, then what are Ezra and Nehemiah doing photobombing Ezra chapter 3? Right? They don't belong in this picture. They weren't there. And if you're going to tell me that it's not, maybe the account of the census was a recount of chapter 3, and then it stops there, and now we're finding out about a later seventh month in the time of Nehemiah. Then I don't understand why Sukkot is news to them. Didn't they do it in Ezra chapter 3?
But more than that, they seem to discover it in Nehemiah.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing.
Celebrating it.
See, you could tell me that Ezra 3 was also a celebration for the first time and it was a shock and they just didn't give me the details. The problem that I have is you can't have it both ways. If Nehemiah is describing what happened in Ezra 3, then how did Ezra and Nehemiah personally get into the picture? Right? Ezra reading the Torah publicly, Nehemiah being involved in the celebration of Sukkot. And if you're going to tell me that he's describing a separate event, then what was the Sukkot that they celebrated back in Ezra? Right. You can't have it both ways. Yeah. All right.
In the chapter 3, they're talking about sacrifice. They don't say anything about Sukkot. So it is possible that the first celebration was a sacrifice part of it. And then after the... All of a sudden, oh my goodness, we have to build Sukkot too.
So Ari Malvin Weisberg says, maybe the answer is that these are in fact two separate events. And yeah, when they did it the first time, they didn't know from Sukkah. What did they know? They knew Karbanos. They knew you bring special offerings to God. They didn't have the details of the Sukkah. Remember, this is a population that either grew up in Babylon, in exile, without the education that they should have had, or it's the elders who remain from the end of the first temple, a period which had dissolved into so much corruption and idolatry and everything else that I wouldn't be shocked to hear that they stopped building a sukkah long before the first temple was destroyed. It's not surprising to me that this would have been news, but maybe what happened was the first account in Ezra 3 is in fact different from what's recounted in Nehemiah 7. They're two different events. And yeah, the Sukkot that they celebrated, even though you sort of wonder would they have called it Sukkot and not known what a sukkah was, but I'll give you a pass on that one. It's entirely possible that what they did was they celebrated by bringing korbanot, bringing offerings, which is what we described as the emphasis here in Ezra 3. And then, in this later event, that was when they did it with the sukkah, because someone actually opened the chumash and said, oh, huts. Okay, let's try that. Take a look at source number one, please, because here I brought you Malvin, who has two answers to the problem. This is one of them. He's willing to go either way. Malvin does not get frazzled. He says, Yesh omrim, some say, Shuhem sheikh shal hadvarim shayu ba'aliyah rishana shayavim ekoresh. Some say that this continues the account of the census, all the events of the first descent in the days of Cyrus. And when it says in sentence 5, and I found the book of lineage, that was the start of the census, and I found written in it, and so on. That goes until the end of chapter 10. Right? Malvin remembers Eastern Europe. It's kapitel, it's not perek. The end of chapter 10. Because all of this record was in that book that he found. So all the things that are going to happen in Nehemiah until chapter 10 are actually recap of things from that first year and so on that they had arrived in the land. But now he has to deal with the problem. Right? Why didn't we like that? We didn't like that idea because Ezra and Nehemiah don't belong. So he says, you know what you're going to have to say? Ulufize nomar, we're going to have to say, She Ezra ala shtei pa'amim. It must be that Ezra came to Israel twice. In other words, he comes in with the first aliyah, then goes back to Bavel, where he has been, as the Gemara told us, a student of Baruch ben Neriah. And then when Baruch ben Neriah dies, he comes back to Israel again. Even the first trip was a pilot trip. That's what you'll have to assume. V'chein Nehemiah alaaz, and Nehemiah as well. It's not beyond thought that this would have happened, meaning Nehemiah has an official role in the king's court. So yes, he goes with the Jews as licensed by the king, but then he goes back to Persia because he has a job to do. And he doesn't return until the king says, okay, now you can go, in that story that we'll see later on. The only real weakness of this version of events is what? What's the weakness of this answer? Yeah?
Why didn't we hear it in chapter 3?
Yeah, why didn't Sefer Ezra say anything about that? I would have thought if Ezra and Nehemiah were there on the first Aliyah, yeah, where we counted everybody and his butler, right? Why didn't anybody say, by the way, Ezra was there, Nehemiah was there? It's very strange to think that they're simply missing from this record. But that's what you're going to have to say if you accept this version of events, right? If you take the view that Nehemiah 7 through 10 is a recounting of what happened in that first year, what we read about in Ezra 3, then you simply have to say that Ezra and Nehemiah were there in the beginning, then they left, and then they came back. And again, the leaving and coming back doesn't bother me as much as the question of why didn't you mention them in the beginning of Ezra. You listed everybody. Like, why in the world did you not put them in your book? That's a very strange thing to me. But the second answer Malvin gives you, still in source 1, V'yesh omrim, and some say, Shemaisezu haisa v'mei Nehemiah achar binyan achoma. These events that we're talking about are actually from Nehemiah's time after the wall is already built, the wall of Yerushalayim. And then I have to deal with the problem of then what was Sukkot like originally. This is Ari's answer. Mashakasav be'ezu v'yasu as chag ha-Sukkos, when we said back in chapter 3, that they celebrated Sukkot. He says, yeah, that referred to Hallel, that referred to the celebration, that referred to the Korbanos, even Lulav and Esro. Hagam shalokimu az mitzvah sukkah karaui, but they weren't doing sukkah properly. Not at that stage. And he says, the flow of the text really indicates this view. Ari's view is more correct. He says, that's what I think happened. I think that Nehemiah 7 to 10 is actually a later event and should not be confused with the events of Ezra 3. That's Malbim's approach. What I find fascinating about this, and I wish that I had thought of this back when we made our introduction of Zerubbabel and so on, what I think I now understand through this, why we have this midrashic insistence that Zerubbabel is Nehemiah. Do you remember when I introduced Zerubbabel, we talked about what his identity is, and Sheish Batzar versus Zerubbabel, and I noted for you at the time this idea in the Medrash that Zerubbabel actually is Nehemiah. And we didn't really have a compelling reason to say so. Like, why should Zerubbabel be Nehemiah? What's the purpose? What's the goal? What have you accomplished? But I think this is why. I think that Medrash is taking the view that Malbim offered first. The view that the events that are in Nehemiah 7 to 10 actually are happening in year 1. They are what happens in Ezra chapter 3. And the Medrash is trying to solve the problem, then why did nobody mention Ezra and Nehemiah? And the answer is, they did. Zerubbabel is Nehemiah. What happens with Ezra is a good question.
So Zerubbabel this way, goes back, and then comes back to Nehemiah.
Correct. He's known as Zerubbabel right now. He will be the same person who will be identified as Nehemiah later on.
Which in the same place together?
No, but that wouldn't stop us. You should just be aware. We have cases like that. The other point that's worth noting, we're going to get back to, but this is going to actually explain a note that Rashi is going to make in chapter 4, and it will likely explain for us as well why it is that, well, we'll see. I don't want to blow the ending.
Yeah.
But there's more to be said about how this works, but I think that's what the Medrash is trying to solve. It just doesn't bother to tell us that. This Medrash is bothered by the same problem that's bothering us. This sequence of events, and it's taking sides and solving the problem. Shayna.
Oh, just because you made this reference before, but to me it makes perfect sense that he was Zerubbabel the first time around because he's still using his Gaulish name.
Mm-hmm. If you take the view that Zerubbabel is a Babylonian name, right, or Persian slash Babylonian.
But then when he comes the second time, it's
right, so he did the age-old practice of Hebraicizing his name upon making Aliyah. There we go. Now I'm here for good. Now I'm Nehemiah.
Yeah, that's very nice, but where is Ezra?
Yeah, exactly.
Right, so Ezra actually, we'll see, also has multiple names. It's not only Nehemiah, but Ezra will also be inserted into this following the same pattern. There's more to discuss about this, and when we get to Nehemiah 7, then we're going to have to solve the other problem, which is the problem of, does it look like they're using their lulav to make a sukkah? And you know, it's not the lulav, Hadassah and the Arava, like what's going on there? So we'll have to see that too. Okay. Well, yeah, but the question would be, why did it get its name? Right? I mean, it's very odd to call it Sukkot and not have a sukkah.
They're using those implements to make a sukkah. They're not. They're using it to celebrate sukkah.
Oh, you're talking about what they do in Nehemiah 7.
Yeah.
Maybe. We'll get there. There's a lot to be said about that when we're there. But right now I'm going to stick with the problems I have in my hands. Dialet Sarah Bishaita. So what we've seen then is that we have this possibility of a parallel section in Nehemiah, or the section in Nehemiah is actually different, in which case we just have this weird celebration of Sukkot, which Malbim solves as he does. Okay. Going forward within chapter 3 now, we are up to Perek Yemel Pasuk Chet, chapter 3, sentence 8. If you're using the stone Tanakh, you want to be on page 1819. Okay, we have built a Mizbeach, we built an altar, but we still don't have a building around it. So let's read together the last verses of this perek, of this chapter, and see what happens. Chapter 3, sentence 8. Uvashana Hashenis, year 2, Livoam el Besa Elokim Lirushalayim Bachodesh Hasheni, the second year of their arrival at the house of God in Yerushalayim. I don't believe that means counting 2 years from when they did the Mizbeach. I think it's still 2 years from when they arrived in the land. I believe that's the case. Bachodesh Hasheni in the second month, the month of Iyar. Second month is Iyar. That's incidentally something that's been bothering me. You start from Nisan. The thing that bothers me about it is that we have a classic idea, which Ramban says, but he's not the only one, start the other way. This month that we are currently in is Tevet, right? Next month is Shvat. How many times in Chumash do you find a month called Tevet or Shvat? The answer is none, not at all. What is the name of each month?
One first, second.
A number. In Chumash, the months are numbered. Bachodesh HaRishon, Bachodesh HaHamishi, whatever it's going to be, it's all numbered. When you move into Navi, you find names for the months, but not the names we are familiar with. What will be the name of Iyar in Navi? Chodesh Ziv. Radiance, which is a nice name for a springtime month, right? Cheshvan is Chodesh Bul. Right, like the clods of earth on the ground in the rainy season. The months have particular names in Tanakh, and those are not the names that we use by and large. Instead, the names we have for the months are Babylonian. And the classic explanation for why in the world we adopt Babylonian names, including some that are associated with Avodah Zarah, like Tammuz, the classic explanation is we adopt them because we have to always remember that we were in exile in Babylon, in Babel. Remember the Babylonian exile. That's the classic answer for why we do this. Ramban goes into this at length. The question I have is this, and I don't have an answer for it. Then why is it that so far we've mentioned months twice in the book of Ezra about the Jews who came out of exile, and each time we've used a number? Right. If that were really when we started to use these names, then it should have said Bachodesh Iyar, not Bachodesh Hasheni. So I don't have an answer. Something to think about. Yes, Helen.
Could it be that we didn't start using those Babylonian names until after the destruction of the second temple?
Oh, that would be interesting. Well, we have to go back through. I would have two problems with that. One would be historical memory, just in terms of remembering it for the 400 and something years, minimum, that have passed in between the Babylonian exile and the Roman. But the other is, these names do appear in Tanakh. We have to go through and see where they show up and figure out at what point are they coming in.
And the motif, which is taken from the leaving Mitzrayim, happens right when they leave Mitzrayim. Like that idea of remembering. So they should be doing it from the moment that they come back, not waiting a period of time.
Yeah, I'm. I don't know. I'm stuck with this one so far. All right.
Maybe they want to reference this to the language in Chumash. You know, that's how we refer to them. The last month, the seventh month.
But then, when did we make this decision of now we're switching? That's the problem, Elisheva.
But the same idea of, if this is the feeling of inferiority, we're trying to kind of regain and raise ourselves, why not, push the bar higher and try to, reclaim the language as well?
Yeah. Okay, but then at what point did we decide to do otherwise? At what point were we so secure that we felt, okay, now we can go back and use Babylonian month names? I don't know. I want to look into this more. I feel like I'm just missing something basic. But in any case, it's the
Babylonian calendar internationally more accepted?
I would expect that it would have been.
So for commerce and all those other reasons, in Israel.
I mean, keep in mind, our system of numbering months is our system. It's parochial. It's based on Nisan because that's when we left Egypt.
What do you write it on a check in Israel?
At which point?
What?
Were you asking today?
Yeah.
I don't know.
February, January.
Yeah? Okay.
Schools, I write it on
Nisan. Okay. So in any case, back in Pasuches, sentence 8. So, in this second month of the second year, Hechelu Zerubbabel ben Shealtiel, V'yeshua ben Yotzedak u'shar achayim ha-kohanim v'alevi'im v'chol abim me'hashvi Yerushalayim Zerubbabel and the Kohen Gadol, Yeshua ben Yotzedak, and all the other Kohanim and Leviim, and all those who came from the captivity taken from Yerushalayim, v'yamidu es ha-Leviim, they set up the Leviim, miben esrim shana v'mala, from the age 20 and up, l'natseach amoleches beis Hashem. The word l'natseach is a very interesting word. I see that the Arshul renders l'natseach as l'natseach, to direct.
Supervise.
Okay, anybody have a different translation? Any of the
oversight.
Okay, oversee, supervise. Yeah, those are basically the same. So we're going to have to talk about what this Nitzuach thing is. We also have a separate problem. Yes?
I just
want to
say about the idea of Manasseh.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. Now, we will go through that. There's a separate problem, though, emerging in this sentence. The age of 20. When do Levim start to serve? I'll give you a hint. If you look at your sheet in source number 3, I point you to the Psukim. We actually have quite a bit of confusion about when Levim start to serve. So, no, that's army. The army is 20. Correct, because I have two different sets of Psukim. One, the Bamidbar 8:24 reference that I gave you on the sheet says when they're age 25. And then the other one, Bamidbar 8:46-47, and other times in that same chapter, says age 30. So that from there, the Gemara gets the idea that they train for 5 years. 25 is when they start training, 30 is when they're now in charge. Either way, it ain't age 20. So we'd have to figure out why the Levium here are starting at age 20. The answer may be, we're short Levium. We're short Levium, so, you know, this is the way it works. Child labor. Sorry?
They all have to be trained. They have to be doing this.
Right, but it isn't even in training. This is it. They're now directing other people. We're putting them in charge. So, let's read what happens. Pasuk Tes, sentence 9. Vayamod Yeshua banav ve'echav. Yeshua, his sons, his brothers, the others are with him, Kadmiel Uvanav Bnei Yehuda, as well as Kadmiel and his kids of Yehuda, right? Yeshua is the Kohen Gadol, and this is a different Yeshua. This is Yeshua himself. Ke'echad, they stand together.
I'm sorry. I got confused by Bnei Yehuda. That's why. The Yehuda doesn't mean the tribe. Yehuda is one of the Shevet Levi, one of the Leviim. That's the trick. Okay. So they get together. L'natzeach al osei amlacha bebeis Elokim to direct, supervise, oversee the work that's being done to build this house. And these are Bnei Chenadad, Bnei Hem, V'acheihem ha-Leviim. Those are the ones. V'yistu abonim es hechal Hashem, v'yamidu akohanim melubashim b'chatzot zeros, v'alevi'im b'nei asaf b'mitziltayim, l'halel es Hashem al-yidei David melech Yisrael. So the builders established the sanctuary of God, and they set up the kohanim melubashim. They're dressed. That's good. What do you think the reference is when it says they're dressed?
The uniform. In their uniform.
Fancy clothing or uniforms? Big day kahuna. Right? They're with chatzotos, with trumpets, and the Leviim, Bnei Asaf, are with the Mitziltayim. Mitziltayim, I think, are symbols, no?
Yes.
La'alel es Hashem al-yidei David melech Yisrael, to sing to God via King David. Meaning? Tehillim, right? The Tehillim of David HaMelech. Vayanu b'halel u'vahodos l'Hashem kitov ki li'olam chasdo al Yisrael. Sound familiar, I hope. And that's what they sing. When it says Vayanu, it's this big declaration. Some of the commentators on Vayanu suggest that it actually means song here, not just to declare, but it's itself a reference to song. Saying, Hodu Lashem Kito, Kili Olam Chazdo, Al Yisrael. His chesed is great upon Israel. We are the ones who are the beneficiaries. V'chol ha'am hiriyu trua gedola, behalel Lashem, al husad beis Hashem, and they all blew a mighty blast. They make a lot of noise. praising Hashem, thanking Hashem on the establishment of the Beis Hamikdash. They have set the work in motion. Parenthetically, when we learn Haggai, he says that later in history they still have not done Yisud. They have not actually laid the foundation. And likely because one generation's foundation to another generation is nothing. You know, they hadn't really gotten going, because we'll see in chapter 4 that this is about as good as things get for a while. They're going to get stopped. So they lay a foundation, but then they run into trouble and they stop and then they have to start again. And at that point we're going to say they haven't yet laid a foundation. Yeah.
Who's
going to do? He is, if I'm correctly, the one who's going to be building.
He's a brother of
the Levites? Yes. Yeah. B'nai Henadad are builders.
And are they Levites?
They are Levites, correct. I believe so. Unless we're going to say, actually, I take that back. I remember there's a lot of confusion with this, and I'm looking at my notes and seeing it. But but going with that mikra for now, he says that B'nai Henadad are builders. They're not singing. I have to come back to it. There's something to be said, but I wanted to go through the psukim.
Somebody's
got
to do the
work. Hang on. And a great number of the Kohanim, the Levim, the heads of the families, the elders who saw what the first one looked like, right? The biyazdo. They see this house now with their eyes. Bochim b'kol gadol, they cried with a loud voice. V'rabim b'tru'av b'simcha l'arim kol. While everybody else is making a big ruckus with celebration and joy. So some of them are crying and some of them are celebrating. V'eina makirim kol tru'at ha'simcha l'kol b'chi ha'am. You couldn't even identify which was which. You couldn't say, I'm listening to celebration and happy celebration because of the sound that was intermingled of the tears. Ki ha'am ri'im tru'a gadola. They're making a lot of noise. V'akol nishma ha'ad. And you can hear it far away, which I believe is meant to lead you into the next sentence. It's a play because it's going to say what they heard. It isn't going to say they heard a loud noise, but it's clearly intended as a play. This was audible far away, and Sarei Yehuda heard dot dot dot. It's a clever bit of cinematography, so to speak. Okay, so those are the last verses of this chapter. So I want to go back now to sentence 8 again and ask, why the second month? Why did they choose this time in order to do the actual construction? Why didn't they just start building right away after Sukkot? Well, maybe it was raining. It was winter time.
Well, it's a lot of strategic planning and getting the material.
Oh, Jews, we for sure had strategic planning. Had to hire consultants and a poll.
Fundraiser.
The funds were in. Cyrus is bankrolling. So I think it's important to remember again this issue of association with the first time round. Go back to Malachim Aleph, Kings 1, Chapter 6, Sentence 1. We are on page 813 in the Stone Tanakh. Chapter 6, sentence 1. Vayhi v'shmonim shana v'arba meyos shana l'tzeis b'nei Yisrael me'eretz Mitzrayim. 480 years after we left Egypt. Ba'shana ha'revi'is, the fourth year. Bechod, meaning the fourth year of the reign of Shlomo. Bechodesh Ziv, there's the name.
Uh-huh.
The month of Ziv, hu achodesh ha'sheni, the second month of Loch Shlomo al Yisrael. Vayhi v'nabayis l'shem, that's when they built the house. Exactly. We are trying to evoke images of the first time round, and so we're going to start building in the same month when Shlomo began his building. We already saw how they dedicated the Mizbeach in the seventh month, as Shlomo dedicated the Beis HaMikdash in the seventh month as well. The only difference between them is that Shlomo doesn't have the act of building a Mizbeach because the Mizbeach predates him. The Mizbeach is already there. He doesn't need to build a Mizbeach, so there's nothing to parallel in that regard. But this is a particularly auspicious time. Now, in terms of the Levium overseeing the work on the Beis HaMikdash starting at the age of 20, so here I'd point you to source number 5 from the Sefer HaChinuch. Sefer HaChinuch, a work that collects the 613 mitzvot and catalogs them, based largely on the thought of the Rambam. So he writes, Ve'ein ha-Levi nifsal la'avoda b'shanim v'lo b'mumin ela b'kilkul ha-kol. He says, the Levi doesn't age out of service based on age. It isn't, he reached a certain age and now he can't sing in the Beis HaMikdash anymore. And it isn't based on you know, physical defect, but rather, it's when his voice stops going. He says, when people get older, sometimes their voice isn't as good. Well, then what do you do with the fact that the Torah says that the Levi stops serving at age 50? The answer is the Levim at the time had a different job description. That's because they were carrying the Mishkan from place to place. You didn't want to have an accident. So you told the Levi, listen, age 50, let somebody else carry the Mishkan. You don't have to do that anymore. So that's in terms of what went on in the in terms of the end of their service. I suspect that the same thing is true in terms of the beginning of their service. What they're doing now is not work that requires a 25 or 30 year old. What they're going to be doing at this stage in the task. What was Linat Sayach? So Rashi says Linat Sayach was actually to sing. He says the association of Laminat Sayach is not only because the Menatzeach is the conductor, but it's actually musical. You know, if you think of sea chanting, right? You know, when you chant and they row at the same time. So the builders are all they did in the movies. There's a guy who calls on the crew teams. No,
yes, and they're named
for it. Right, it's an old the Charles River in Boston.
Yeah.
So the same way you have. People who are responsible to sing, and their singing will keep the people working on pace. That's Rashi. Ibn Ezra says that it's actually stronger than that. Ibn Ezra says it means Lenatzeach is actually to strengthen, right? Nitzachon being victory. That's his take. And Mitzudat David Adapta, take a look at source number 6. Mm-hmm. He says Lenatzeach Lingos Alehem. Right, lingos is a harsh word. We associate that with Egypt, right? With the slaves in Egypt, with Noksim. I translated lingos aleihem to make them work because I couldn't really render it as to oppress them. But that's what it sounds like.
You need supervising.
Yeah, but this is stronger than that. It's not just supervising. Laval yirpu yadeihem min hamalacha, lest they weaken their hands from their work. This is supported by the Gemara in Chulin as well. Take a look at source number 7. The Gemara talked to me about the earliest age for Levim to serve. Me'im asai kosher la'avoda, the Gemara asks. At what point is he kosher to serve? Mishayavi shtei saros, from the point of physical puberty. Rebbe Omer, Omerani achei ben Esrim. Rebbe says he has to be 20 years old. Omer Chista, my time at the Rebbe. Chista says, why does he have to be 20? Then he quotes our pasuk. He quotes what we've been discussing, the sentence that says, Levim are set up at the age of 20. Ve'idach, and how will the others respond who say he can start much earlier? Why does it say 20 here? Lenatzeach sha'ani, overseeing is different. It's more strenuous than pure singing. If it was just pure singing, he could sing from a younger age. However, there is more work than that, and therefore he has to be somewhat older than someone who's just going to be singing. But it doesn't need to be 25 or 30. So, in other words, the point that I want you to draw from this is, it's not a contradiction of the age that the Chumash gives you for when Levim start to work. The age that they start working depends on the job you have for them. Are they singing? Are they leading a work crew? Or are they carrying a Mishkan? That's going to matter in terms of determining what their age is. In terms of the other question, going back to Rabbi Ostriker's point here about this chenadad and trying to understand who is doing what in this sentence, I spent a lot of time trying to figure out who is doing what in sentence 9. This is the best that I can figure out. It actually is, and I'm basing myself on Malbim here. The best I can figure out is Yeshua Banav Ve'echav is one group. Kadmiel and his kids, who are B'nai Yehuda, and they're the ones who are menatzeach, and then you have b'nei chenadad, who are builders, not singers. In other words, the builders are b'nei chenadad, b'neihem v'achayim halaviyim. The only ones who are the singers slash overseers are the ones who are Yeshua and his kids and Kadmiel and his kids. And the reason why it needs to say Kadmiel and his kids who are B'nai Yehuda is because, here's this, how's this for confusion? In Nehemiah Perek Yud, Pasuk Yud, Nehemiah 10:10, we will meet a Kadmiel who is a son of Chenadad. So in order to distinguish and say, no, not that Kadmiel, it says B'nai Yehuda. But it doesn't mean Yehuda, the tribe. Yehuda is a person. That's the way to read it. Exactly. It's a very confusing sentence. I don't even know. How did they do it in here? What did they say in the art scroll? Did they make it any clearer? Yeshua, his sons and kinsmen, Kadmiel and his sons of the children of Judah, arose as one to direct the workers in the temple, as well as the sons of Chenadad. So he is not taking Malbim's view. He's viewing them as not being that way. I assume that's from Rashi, but I didn't see that in Rashi. Okay. It's a very confusing question in terms of who's doing what in this sentence.
It refers back to the character of Pasuk 40. Would it be the son of Yeshua Kadmiel, the son of Hodaviah?
Right, Hodaviah being Yehuda. Right. Right. Okay. So, whoever's doing this, you have the song going on, you have the building going on, and the Levim sing praise of God while the construction is happening, and they use the songs of David HaMelech. So I thought that was a very interesting point in light of what I brought you in source number 8 on your sheet. What songs did the Levim sing in the Beis HaMikdash in general? What was the text that they sang? We have Shir Malos in terms of the 15 steps, right, going up to the Duchan. We also have the Shir Shalyo, right, the song of the day, which we have, which always comes from Tehillim, as do the Shir Malos paragraphs. Was that always the case?
Couldn't have been,
right? Why not? Yeah, there's an Avoda in the Mishkan. What are they singing in the Mishkan? David ain't born yet. So you'll say, well, some of the Tehillim are credited back to earlier people. Moshe ben Korach, Adam HaRishon. Is that what we're meant to understand? When the Torah talks about your Avoda being besimcha with joy, and the Gemara in Erchin says, that means specifically Shira. So is this like a pasuk that's telling me you're obligated to use Tehillim? So the Minchas Chinuch says no. The Minchas Chinuch is Rabbi Yosef Babad's commentary on the Sefer HaChinuch, a brilliant work on many levels. Take a look at what he has to say on this point in source number 8. He says, "Hatara tzivsa l'shorer ulahodos lo yisbarach ala korban mashe yirtzu kepitzachos l'shonim." He says the mitzvah is to sing in whatever way they choose, based on tzachut l'shonam, which I translated as their eloquence. That was the best I could do with tzachut l'shonam. It means the purity of their tongue, but it means how good is your songwriting. The Achar Zeh, but after this, Ba'David HaMelech, Olav HaShalom, he said, Mizmorim Al Zeh, then along came David, and he established these chapters of Psalms for this purpose. Kamo B'Tfila, it's just like with davening. Sheyim in HaTorah L'Das HaRambam, the Rambam's view is that the mitzvah of davening is biblical, right? That's a classic debate. Is davening a biblical mitzvah? Is it a rabbinic mitzvah? The Rambam says that prayer to God is a biblical mitzvah to pray at least once a day. But at the same time, the Rambam also writes that the text is not dictated biblically. Where do you get your text from? The Great Assembly, early Second Temple, are the ones who say, this is what you're going to say as your minimum text for prayer. So what are they doing until then? Whatever they come up with. So the same thing is true here, right? The same thing is true for benching. The blessing after meals. You have a biblical mitzvah. You shall bless. But you don't have a text yet. You have certain ideas that have to be expressed as part of your thank you. But you don't have a particular text in the earliest stages. Ditto for the songs of Levim until they adopt Tehillim. Okay. It's interesting to see his wording. He says that David actually intended it to be for this. Which makes a lot of sense, because when you read the chapters of Tehillim and they begin with Laman HaTzeach, or they identify a particular chord, a particular instrument, It's because it was a performance piece. It was meant to be done that way. Okay. So the Kohanim, we're told, are melubashim. They're wearing clothing, which in general is a good idea. So what do you mean when you say that they're wearing clothing? And not only that, it also says they're blowing trumpets. That's actually unusual. When are you supposed to blow trumpets?
War.
War is one purpose. Sorry? Yovel has trumpets / shofar, right? But you have Ubiom Simchasem of Moadechem of Rashecha Chechem Uskatem Bachatzotzros, right? Parshas Paulos, Abamidbar, somewhere in chapter 8. That there are certain days that are festival days. That's when you blow the Chatzotzros. Sometimes they're just shofar, sometimes there are Chatzotzros, these trumpets. This wasn't any of them. This is Iyar. Yom HaTzimut hasn't happened yet. Yom Yerushalayim hasn't happened yet. Lag BaOmer hasn't happened yet. Why are they blowing trumpets in Iyar? Where did this come from? Sorry? Just because it's a celebration. It's a moment of great joy. Correct. So take a look at the Malbim in source number 9. He addresses both of these questions. First of all, he says, Melubashim, that they're clothed, Bibigdei Kavod, Kain Pirish Rashi. He says, Rashi says, clothed means in garb of honor. In other words, not Bigdei Kahuna. They're not wearing the clothing of the Kohanim. They're wearing nice clothing. Vizela Dasa Rambam. And he says, yeah, that's consistent with the view of the Rambam. Perechas Hilchas Klei HaMikdash. Shalohutur LaKohanim Lubosh Bigdei Kahuna Shalobish As Avodah. That the Kohanim are only allowed to wear their uniforms when they're actually performing the temple service. Other than that, you don't get to wear the special uniform. But if you were to take the view of the Ravid, who says you could wear it even if you're not actually engaged in the act of a voter right now, so you could explain that their garbed means garbed in the special uniform of the Kohanim, the four garments that a Kohen wears. And even if you are the Rambam, Yesh Lomar, you could still say, they wore the garb of the Kohanim because they did the daily offering, the Karban Tamid, and they had to turn the offering from time to time on the altar, on the Mizbeach, so that comes up in the Sefer Shmuel. And therefore they could wear the clothing all day. They put it on to do the service, and from time to time they have to go back and deal with the service. So keep the clothing on. It's not worth it to take your tie off for the half an hour that you have as a break. That's the message that Malbim is giving here. And then in terms of the trumpets, he says, "Va'kohanim lahiu tokim b'chatzotzros rak b'mei hamoados." He says they only blew the chatzotzros on festivals. Kamosh kasev Rambam, as the Rambam wrote, "V'haya zehoras shah shechashvu kimoed b'nei rov simchasam." However, this was a special dispensation. This is a holiday. We're building the Beis Hamikdash. We're building the temple. You better believe that we're going to blow the chatzotzros. That's the idea. Yes. Yes, Yeshua ben Yotzadak is Kohen Gadol.
And does he have all of the Shonim of the
Kohen Gadol? Right. So he has all of the garments. He has all the Bidei Kehuna. But the Urim Betumim, we're told, don't function with Nevuah. They don't have the prophetic element that they had in the first Beis HaMikdash.
But he has the tzitz.
He has the tzitz of Saint Kodesh Lashem. That's my understanding. If I remember correctly. There is a discussion about how he lifted his arms in the second. I have to go back and take a look if there's any reason to think he didn't have the tzitz, but I believe he had it. I believe he did have it.
What about when did they prepare these cousins? I thought they're so complicated together.
Apparently they did it, according to this view. I mean, Rashi didn't seem to think they had it. But remember, this is... Right, Rashi said they did it. But what Malbim is saying is that you could argue that they did have it and that it was okay to use. In terms of when they did it, remember, we're already in the second month, right, of year two. Now, they didn't necessarily have a full year of year one because we don't know what date they arrived in Israel. But we know that they've been there at least since the seventh month of year one, right? That was when they built the Mizbeach. And the truth of the matter is they actually have to have it because you can't necessarily do Avodah without Bigdei Kehuna. Yeah, there were requirements. So come to think of it, they had to have done it somehow. Someone made this stuff. Okay. So they have their celebration, and they have their construction, but not everybody is happy. Right? You have your mix of emotions here. And I gave you some references to take a look at. You don't have to look at it right now, but I gave you references in source number 10 to other examples of this attitude of our Beis HaMikdash is nothing. It isn't what we once had. Ranging from outright tears, described in Haggai, to the point when they write a letter from Bavel to Zechariah and say, should we still continue to fast on Tisha B'Av and on our various fasts because the temple still isn't the temple. We aren't still redeemed. So this approach of skepticism is what I've been referring to all along when I said that's why you want to mirror what happens in the first to the extent you can. So you appoint Yoshua ben Yotzadak as your Kohen Gadol, which is now even stronger if I take the view that Ezra actually was around. Right? The fact that we still appoint Yoshua is because his father, his grandfather, is the last Kohen Gadol in the first temple. You use those dates, you use the cedar wood that Shlomo used, you're going to try to mirror the first Beis HaMikdash to whatever extent you are able. Clear? Okay. So to summarize, because we spent a long time on this chapter, because we started this chapter, I think, like Sukkot time, there was a lot here. But number one, we met some interesting personalities. Actually, no, sorry, just summarizing chapter 3, not chapter 2. Let's not go too far back. But in chapter 3, we met Zerubbabel, this political leader who may be the same as Shesh Batzar, and hey, maybe Nehemiah. And we learned about how he becomes a focal point for the national transition, as we'll see, from being subjects of the Persians to a nation that thinks that it's creating an autonomous kingdom under Mashiach, as we'll see as we go along. The issue, we also met Yoshua ben Yehotzadak, the Kohen Gadol. Going further back, we had the census, which we included in chapter 2, but I don't think I'm going to go through that whole thing again. We spent enough time on that. But we entered our new land. They did not go to Yerushalayim immediately, whether it was because they needed to have safety and you'd have a wall in Yerushalayim, whether it's because they need to plant and they need to set up jobs, which they're not going to have by starting immediately in Yerushalayim, whether it's because they want the seventh month, as we talked about. And then we talked about the weakness that they feel for not matching the first Beis HaMikdash, which we just recapped now, and we dealt also with the problem of whether Nehemiah 7 is this or is something else. All of that is going to bring us now to chapter 4, which I'd like to take a couple of minutes just to get started on, even though we're not going to be able to get very far into it. Chapter 4, I gave you the outline of it on your sheets, is going to begin with the Jews being approached by the neighbors. Nice house you're building here, they say. That's great. We would like to be part of your project. And the Jews respond, absolutely not. We are not building it along with you. No way. The result of that is harassment by the neighbors, including a letter they sent to Persian king, who is not Cyrus at this point, it's Artaxasta, saying, these Jews are trouble, don't let them continue building. And in fact, the construction is going to be halted. The construction is going to be halted. Yeah, no, anything that sounds familiar is familiar, yes. You got it. So there are a few key points to discuss within this. Number one, obviously, the identity of our local enemies, right? Who are these people and what are they trying to do? What was it that they wanted? And why did we reject their offer? I mean, the offer looks benign on paper. When you read it here, it doesn't seem like there's any reason to not like them. So the question is, who are these people to begin with? And that will determine everything else. So I gave you a reference on your sheet in source number 13 to Malachim Bet. And this we do have to see inside. Kings 2. Kings 2, chapter 17. And it is page 923. We're going back to the end of the kingdom of Yisrael. You have the northern kingdom, Yisrael, that is led by Hoshea ben Elah. the southern kingdom at this point is under Ahaz. It will then be under Hezekiah. But our focus is actually the northern kingdom right now, as they are attacked by the Assyrians. So take a look, please, at sentence 1. It's on page 923. We're just going to go through quickly sentences 1 to 6. It's the 12th year of Ahaz, king of Yehuda. Hoshea ben Eli is king over Yisrael in the Shomron. Reigns for 9 years. He does what is evil in the eyes of God, but he's not as bad as the other kings of Israel, which is high praise. That's as good as it gets in the kings of Israel. Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, went to war against him, and Hoshea became his vassal. He subjugates the northern kingdom. Yisrael is now under the control of the Assyrians. However, then the king of Assyria discovers Hoshea has betrayed him, and he sends messengers to the king of Egypt. Hoshea had sent messengers to the king of Egypt and had not paid his tribute, and therefore the Assyrians come back, they lock up Hoshea ben Elah, they invade, and they lay siege to the Shomron. In the 9th year of Hoshea, they capture the Shomron, and here is the key in sentence 6, they exile Yisrael to Assyria, Halach, Chavor, etc. So the northern kingdom is now gone. Those become the 10 lost tribes. It's not actually 10. We've discussed that on other occasions, right? You know that in the south you have Yehuda, Binyamin, Shimon, and some of the Levium. Aside from the fact that in Divrei HaYamim we will find out that there were others from these other tribes who were also among Yehuda. So don't get caught up in whether it's actually 10. It doesn't matter. Not right now, anyway. What does matter for us is sentence 24. If you flip the page. The period, the section in between sentence 7 and sentence 24 just gives us a quick recap of the sins of the northern kingdom that led to their being exiled. But if you start with sentence 24, the king of Assyria brought people from Babel and Kuta, Kuta being what gives them the name that they're known by in the Gemara, which is Kutim. And Ava, Hamat, Sepharvayim, all of these different places, and he settled them in the cities of Samaria in place of the children of Israel. They took possession of the Shomron and they dwelled in its cities. So your Shomronim, your dwellers of Shomron, are not Jews right now. They are people who came from elsewhere and were settled there by the Assyrians. I think I'm actually going to pause with that, because that's where the trouble is going to start when they get attacked by lions. So that's, I think, where we're going to pick up next time, and then we'll start to understand a little bit about the bad blood between them and the Jews who are back to build the Beis HaMikdash. Thank you very much.